Vipassana. So this afternoon we return to practice of settling the mind in its natural state. And a theme that comes up very frequently in the teachings on this practice are that when you do sustain that quality of mindfulness without distraction, without grasping, that the contortions of the mind, the twistedness, the knots of the mind, of mental afflictions, of resentments, rumination, and so forth, unravel themselves. They release themselves. Rang de, release themselves. They naturally release. So there could be a couple of ways of understanding that. That you don't have to actually apply some antidote from outside. Just stop the grasping, and then they heal themselves. They cure themselves. Well, a very superficial way of viewing that would be to take any mental affliction. By and large, mental afflictions have objects. So let's take my trusty old iPhone here. I could be very attached to it. I could be, and when I look at it, I could feel, oh, my iPhone. I could feel a lot of attachment arising. But then as soon as my mind gets distracted and I think I look over some water, I think I'm thirsty, then the attachment that was arising for the iPhone vanishes in an instant. Because the mind consists of this moment, this sequence of just momentary bursts, instants of cognition. So as I'm focusing on the object of attachment, then from moment to moment, like a machine gun, little bullets, attachment, 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 attachment. I want it, I want it, I like 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 it. As long as I'm focusing on it, but as soon as I shift over, oh, there's some water, then the attachment in that instant is gone. And now water, yeah, water's okay. I maybe have a little sip, but no big deal. Yeah, no better than I thought it would be. It just tastes like water. You know, so no attachment, no aversion, just like it is water. And so there is a very superficial way of understanding the wrong rule. Just get your mind off of it, and then that attachment just releases itself. Well, it's not really releasing itself, it's just not being fed any longer. So I could be wandering around, looking at things I like and I don't like, and then I come back and it, oh, iPhone, I like it, 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 I like it. And so as soon as I come back to the object, the attachment, the craving that went dormant is all ready to come out for a feeding frenzy all over again. And that goes, if I can't stand this iPhone, I'm disgusted, it's so old and so forth, don't like it, don't like it, don't like it, don't like it. So the aversion is there as long as I focus on it, oh, but there's water, that's okay. And then, oh, that disgusting iPhone, hate it, hate it, hate it, hate it, hate it. So either way, it just goes dormant, but nothing solved. You haven't even moved one inch towards any kind of a balancing, a healing of the mind, let alone towards liberation, just by directing your attention elsewhere. So when some thought of craving arises, and you enter into cognitive fusion with it, so you're really thinking it, of course, then your attention goes off to the referent of the thought. I want the new iPhone that's coming out in the fall. Oh, it'll be make me so happy. And so then there it is. And so when I'm thinking, oh, what joy it will be to have that kind of technology, then the attachment is arising now. It doesn't have to be visually seen. It can be imagined. But, oh, if I have such an iPhone, it'll make me so happy. And so there it is. It's focusing on its feeding, just like as if you're seeing it right in front of you. But then as soon as you shift the focus of your attention away from the referent, and that is the technology that you want, and you're focusing simply on the image or even just on the impulse of desire, as you're focusing on that, in that instant, the craving may, again, just dissolve. Because, again, you've cut off its supply line, its food. And that is attachment, craving, survives by focusing on that which we're attached to our craving, right? And likewise for anger and so forth. So that's one way of understanding this wrongdoer business, this self-liberation, is as long as you're simply attending to the mental events arising, and you're attending to them without distraction, without grasping, then you're not latching onto the reference of the thoughts that arouse craving, hostility, or any other mental affliction. Therefore, the craving and hostility don't arise. Or if they do arise, and you just focus on the event right now, then it naturally dissipates. So there's a superficial, kind of very straightforward way of understanding rangdu, but I think it's actually very superficial. I think there's something deeper going on. And I think this reveals itself through practice. So see for yourself. I'm just speculating here. But here's a practice where we're bringing a very special quality of awareness and we're directing it to the mind. And you might recall the statement that, again, is very interesting to test with your own experience. And that is when some impulse of aversion, hostility, anger, resentment, hatred arises. Of course, when we're focusing on the object of our aversion, then it just feeds on that. But if, as soon as we can direct our attention to the mental affliction itself, and just looking right into it with a lot of interest, without fear, without anxiety, without the cognitive fusion, then you may see that that impulse itself that's arising is of the very nature of luminosity. There's something very bright, something very sharp, clear, luminous about anger. It sharply illuminates its object. If I'm really angry at, okay, a piece of technology, then I've got a real sharpness there, like a sharp edge of, you know, like kind of cutting. When somebody speaks very harshly, we say, oh, your words are so cutting. A sharp luminous, like a bright blade that goes in. So is that true or not? You can see whether anger has, before it gets all afflicted, convoluted, twisted, and is riveted on its object, whether its nature is actually luminosity, and you know where that's coming from. And likewise, when craving, attachment, desire arises, right, if you don't get fixed on the object, but observe the impulse itself, you may see there's something very pleasant. I want it. That would make me happy if I had it. I've got it. I'm so glad I've got it. Either way, it's very positive. There's something pleasing there. So is the very nature of craving and attachment. Is it not bliss? And where does that come from? And then on occasion, again, if you're kind of just sitting in there, kind of slipping into laxity, into dullness, as some of you have already found out through your own experience, it's quite peaceful. Spacing out. Very peaceful. And non-conception. Where's the non-conceptuality coming from? Got it. So that might be some indication right there that among those three root poisons, they all trace right back to the three fundamental qualities of the substrate consciousness. But I think there's more too, just within the shamatha context, let alone Dzogchen. Within the shamatha context, there's more too, this whole theme of rangdu, that these thoughts, these afflictions, the convolutions of the mind can unravel themselves if you just attend to them. And that is, here's a hypothesis, and that is all of these are stemming from the substrate consciousness itself anyway. And that when they're streaming up there and you're not freezing them, that's a Dzogchen analogy, you're not freezing them, you're not fixing on them, you're not locking in on them, which then rigidifies them. It's just attending to them with that very fluid, that very spacious, soft awareness. They don't get rigidified, in which case then the source starts to take over. The source reaches up, and there's nothing to prevent it from melting them. And that's, again, a Dzogchen metaphor. So what if we think of, we go right down to the depths of Rigpa itself, a classic analogy, as Holiness has used it, Dujom Lingpa uses it, others use it, and that is Rigpa in its natural state, pristine awareness. It's like fluid water. But then, when it manifests and gets caught up in grasping, one could say it becomes, if one wants to push this analogy a little bit, by the time it gets caught up in grasping at the level of some substrate consciousness, it's like that fluid, utter fluidity of the pristine awareness turns into sludge. Sludge. You know? And then when it comes out of the sludge of the substrate and manifests in the coarse mind, locked into dualistic grasping, craving, hostility, and so forth, then it's frozen. Frozen. So there's a strong Dzogchen analogy. That the ordinary mind, where we're, and it's not just thoughts, but it's our whole perception of reality, this dualistic grasping, the frozenness, the rigidification of this the separation between subject and object. It seems locked in, it seems absolute, it seems totally objective and real. Absolutely over there, absolutely over here. Rock solid. You know? That's the frozenness of pristine awareness. It starts to melt by the time you settle in substrate consciousness, but more to sludge, and then break through that and you go into the pure fluidity of pristine awareness. But what all of this suggests to me is that there is a fundamental sanity in resting in the substrate consciousness. Compared to the dualistic mind, the coarse mind, this is pretty sane. It's blissful. That's an indication of good health. It's luminous. That's got to be good. Non-conceptual, that is not compulsively caught up in thinking, that's got to be good. And so there's a fundamental sanity there that just, you know, it's yours, and it's just covered over. And so when you don't cover it over with distraction and grasping, then that sanity flows right out of the substrate consciousness, and it starts to heal itself. So it's like a wound, like an abrasion. If you just keep it clean, the basic healthiness, if one could say, of the body says, oh, there's an injury here. But if you keep out of the way, I'll take care of it. And then lo and behold, if it's not too gaping, if you don't need stitches, then it just starts to do its work. And all you have to do is get out of the way. Just don't get it dirty. Right? And then lo and behold, that, broken bones, warding off virus infections, bacterial infections, and so forth, the body has an extraordinary capacity to heal, and so does the mind. And now it's just on a relative level, the healing capacity of the mind stems right there from the substrate consciousness. It wants to heal that which is emerging from it, but we block it. Go to the deepest level, then you're down to Rigpa, and then it gets all the more interesting. But I won't go there this afternoon, but I think this within the context of shamatha is significant. When they say rangdo, this self-natural liberation, this natural release in the context of settling the mind, this natural state, I think it's stating such something much more interesting and profound, meaningful, than if you take your mind off of it, then it doesn't feel so bad. Get really angry, well, listen to some pretty music, or watch television, or read a comic book, and then your anger vanishes. Nothing solved. Whereas if you settle the mind in this natural state for 5,000 hours or so, 10 hours a day, that's not like watching a comic book. You know, some shift really took place. And when you achieve shamatha, it's not like having read a comic book for 5,000 hours, and then you put it down and it's business as usual. Something took place. And that a mind has now shifted into another gear, into a fundamental platform of sanity. And the Buddha said, you know, until you're there, and I can't quote him exactly, but very closely, he said, as long as your mind isn't there, you have not even achieved the first jhana, or even the access to it. He said, your mind is enslaved. It's in bondage, in chains. It's sick. It's wandering on a desert track. So that's for everybody who hasn't achieved shamatha. You are sick. You may think you're healthy, but that's just because you're surrounded by a whole bunch of people just as sick as you are. If you'd met somebody who's healthy, then you'd see how sick everybody else is. But when you don't have shamatha buddies who've already achieved shamatha, then you think, I'm as healthy as everybody else. As you spit out, you know, one obscuration after another. So he's raising the bar. He's really saying you're not even sane until you've achieved the first jhana. I don't know how else to read it. And so you can practice Vajrayana and Dzogchen and Bopo and Dumo and Chit and Vipassana and all kinds of stuff. You can do that. You're sick as a puppy, but you can call yourself a Dzogchen puppy, you know. But your mind is still sick. And Dzogchen was not designed to do the work of shamatha, nor was vipassana, nor is state regeneration or completion designed to make you sane. They're assuming you are sane. And then you use that sane mind to apply it to vipassana, state regeneration, completion, mahamudra, Dzogchen, and so forth. It's kind of assuming, saying, that's why Ledap Lingba says, having settled your mind in its natural state, this is a basis for all samadhis of the state regeneration and completion. I don't know how you say it more clearly than that. That's what he said. That's a direct quote. So let's move then on to, I'm happy to see Laura's back with us. Then the question Laura raised, I believe, is now actually 2 days ago, pertinent to all of this. And that is, if it's true, and we should simply take this as a hypothesis, unless you just like to believe it, which is fine, but if it's true that it is our natural heritage, our birthright, this substrate consciousness, let alone the deeper level of Rigpa, Buddha nature, but just the substrate consciousness, if that's true, bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality, that's our birthright, then why aren't we experiencing it all the time? And of course you know the answer, that's because it's obscured. And then we ask, obscured by what? And in the classic Buddhist teachings, now we're going right back to the Pali Canon, and it runs through all schools of Buddhism, It's not a sectarian issue at all. So there's broad consensus. Five obscurations are often called five hindrances, but the Tibetan dipa nga suggests more obscuration rather than hindrance. And so what are these five obscurations that obscure these innate qualities of your own substrate consciousness or subtle continuum of mental consciousness? And the first of these is craving or attachment for bounties, the attractiveness, the pleasantness of the desire realm. That is, we open our eyes, ears, our mouths, smells, touch, open our imagination, say, what looks good? You know, it's kind of like we were born into a candy shop. What looks good here? Oh, this is the desire realm. Yep, I'm ready. I want that and that and that, and I don't want that and that and that. And, oh, something, I want that one too. You know? And it's everything focused outwards. What's going to make me happy? What's going to give me some pleasure? Or what's going to give me some pleasure? What's going to give me a thrill? And what's going to make me feel safe? Calm, relaxed, quiet, still. So one of the three. And then, okay, I want a Mercedes-Benz. That will do it for security, not much thrills. Thrills, for that I want a Porsche. Bliss, I want a really beautiful woman in the passenger seat. Or whatever, you know. It's your daydream. But you're going to find something that symbolizes it for you, whether it's an attractive partner, whether it's a car, whether it's fame, whether it's food, something to smell, taste, touch, and so forth. And so as long as you're fixated on that, fixated is a good word, well, here's the metaphor used. If you liken your substrate consciousness to a crystal clear, limpid, transparent pool of water, okay? Clear, limpid, clear, luminous. See right through it. If you say that, that's the space of your mind, the substrate, subject consciousness. Then, when you're caught up in an attachment of that sort to the bounties of the desire realm, it's like you've tinted the whole pool with a certain color. Like red for attachment. Indigo, how about that? For anger, hatred, and wrath. White. Delusion. How about yellow, pride? And I do find it interesting that in English we say, you are what color with envy? Yeah, that's the Buddhist color. The color of envy is green. So you can tint the pool of water of your mind with any color you like. But when you look into the water, all you see is the color. And you don't see the limpidity, the transparency, the clarity of the water itself. So that obscures it. So craving, of course, it fixates you elsewhere. There's no way you're going to see the clarity here when you're looking someplace else for the stuff that actually lies within. That's one obscuration. But then we look, and this was Laura's question, and this I find absolutely remarkable, really utterly remarkable. And that is, if you had teachings, many of you have, especially in Tibetan Buddhism, all right, we've got a problem here of attachment, craving, and so forth for, let's say, the eight worldly dharmas, right? We've heard these before. Material acquisition. I want four of them. Material acquisition. I want sensual pleasures. I want praise, and I want to have good reputation. So there's four classic, right? And then we think, in a developmental model, you got these four problems, four modes of attachment that will really get you stuck. So what do you do is bring in the antidotes. How do you remedy that? Because you're really stuck. Right? Well, you bring out the sledgehammers. Bring out the sledgehammers. Start meditating on the three modes of suffering, the six modes of suffering, the eight modes of suffering, the six realms of existence, the three modes of death. You're going to die. You're going to die any moment. And when you die, nothing of this is going to count at all. You beat the crap out of it, you know? With meditation on impermanence, mortality, suffering, karma, until... I'm sorry. You know, you kind of give up. You kind of just pulverize that desire. So all the fun has gone out of it. And that's one way of getting rid of it. It's a developmental approach. You bring in the outside troops, and they just, you know, until there's none of that attachment for samsara left, you know, just all mowed down, right, by the special forces of the Buddha Dharma. That's one way of doing it. And it certainly can work. Boy, I know a lot of geishas. There was one Geshe Dashi, I think, again Dashi. He lived up at Leah's place. This simple, simple monk, really super simple. He lived in one little dark room. It was like a closet in the house of a friend of mine. He lived there, hardly ever saw him. Really serene, but he just wore rags and really skinny and always seemed very serene. And if you looked at him, I could speak Tibetan, so I could speak with him. Always cheerful, but just always the same mood. He was always just gentle, grounded, serene, very cheerful, but calmly cheerful. Never, whoa, like that. Just, like that. And I or somebody asked him, Gena, what do you meditate on? The hell realms. Eighteen of them. So there's a lot of work. There's a lot you can meditate on. You know? Each one is very colorful. A lot of very vivid imagery. And that was his answer. Meditate on the hell realms. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, he loves the meditations. The guided tour. All the cold hells, the eight cold hells, the eight hot hells, the two peripherals. Don't miss the peripherals, you know. They're interesting. You know? Like living in a lava pit. So that's a developmental approach. You know, bring in the outside troops and mow down the enemy. It's one way of doing it. And it certainly works for some people. No criticism. What I find and I don't find that so interesting. I think that works for many, many people. And I've done it myself. It can be helpful. But what I find fascinating is as you're simply developing shamatha, in the process of that, naturally, whether you're a Buddhist or not, whether you know anything about Buddhist theory or not, as you're simply developing the attentional balance, moving along the path of shamatha, then five dhyana factors start to arise naturally. They're part of the package. They just come up. You don't learn them from outside. You don't memorize them. They just come up. And one of those is, and it's kind of an obvious one, you're practicing shamatha, what happens? Sensei-chipa. Your mind becomes single-pointed. Your mind becomes unified, composed, in focus. Not rigid, just focused. You've all had that experience, at least for a little while. You know what it's like. That turns out to be a natural antidote for the craving for the bounties of the desire realm. Natural antidote. Meets it head-on collision, and one gives way. And it's that craving gives way. You can't stand it. You can't withstand the head-on collision with a single-pointedness of mind. Turns out to be true. It's quite fascinating. Again, part of it can be understood in the superficial way. Well, you're not focusing on watermelons or Porsches or beautiful women or handsome men or anything like that. You're focusing on your breath. So, of course, that desire is not going to arise. But there's something deeper than that. Something deeper than that. Your mind is becoming unified. It's slipping down into the substrate consciousness. Because it's not unified in some object of desire. Even the sensations of the breath are not an object of desire. It's getting unified, but it's getting unified not in something that's locking you into the desire realm. Getting unified into something that's going to drop you into the sinkhole of your substrate consciousness. And that overcomes the desire for what's up on the surface. That's one obscuration. There's obscuration of, it's called, is it a little bit of an order there? Which one do I want to go to? I know all of them, but I'm trying to think. Do you remember the order? Go ahead. What's that? Ill will, that's right, that's good. Ill will, sure. Ill will, malice, enmity. Quite so. Yeah, that is the second one for sure. Well, that definitely, boy, if you're caught there, you've really obscured this blissfulness of your own substrate consciousness, clarity and so forth. You've definitely obscured it. You're locked onto that which is really pissing you off, that's giving rise to the ill will and the malice and so forth. And so the analogy for that is, there you've got your pool of water, it's boiling. It's boiling. Bubbles all over the place. How can you possibly see into the water when you look at it? It's just boiling, 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 just boiling. Can't see into it. So your mind's frothing. So that obscures the nature of your own awareness. Sure. So, then if we say, okay, here's a mental affliction, craving, anger, hostility, but then really forms into ill will or malice, enmity, what's the remedy? course, there's all kinds of remedy. Chantideva in A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life has a long chapter on patience, all designed to overcome anger, hostility, hatred, ill will. Big chapter, marvelous chapter, it's a classic. And it's developmental, brings just a whole array of modes of thinking, of insight, and so forth, something to learn and apply to your mental affliction of anger, ill will, and so forth. It's very powerful. Very powerful. That's developmental. You learn it from outside, you apply it, and it's like medicine you take in from the outside, and it starts to heal. Oh, the affliction. But then we turn right back as you're developing shamatha, then these five jhana factors come up. And one of them, some of you have already experienced, or at least had little glimpses of it, it's called in Sanskrit sukha. Sukha. Sense of well-being. A sense of well-being. I'm not talking bliss here. It's just kind of like you're resting there in meditation, and it doesn't have to be something intense, but it's kind of like, this feels good. Sukha. This feels good. I like this. I feel well. I don't want to stop. That's sukha. It doesn't have to be exciting, but it's pleasant. It's pleasant. And it does get more intense, and then it really starts to blossom, to come to a kind of fulfillment. It's just a genuine sense of well-being. Sukha, sukha. Well, when your heart, when your mind, your whole being is just filled with a sense of wellness, of, this is good. There's no way at the same time you're going to feel malice. Something's got to give. If malice comes in, the sukha's gone. But if sukha's there, there's no way. I feel so good and I hate your guts. May you die, you son of a gun. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. One's going to give way. It's a natural antidote. But it's coming right out of the meditation. You don't need to go out fishing for it. Or get it from Buddhism or from your teacher or anything outside. So it's a natural antidote. Quite interesting. Next one, how about Gurpa Rangyurpa? Gurpa Rangyurpa in Tibetan. Gurpa, excitation. Gurpa literally means remorse or guilt. Can also have a quality of anxiety built into it. Guilt, anxiety often go hand in hand, and of course excitation, you know a lot about that. And so there's an obscuration. Clearly, that's going to obscure the qualities of your own substrate consciousness. The analogy there is like there's your pool of water, but the surface is whipped with waves, whipped with wind, wind-swept. So, rippling, 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 all, well, there's no way you can see through it. Not when there's all those waves on the surface. So you're held up on the surface, you don't go down to the depths, because your mind is restless, agitated, excited, anxious, feeling guilty, like that. Well, that'll blow it. So there's a third one. There's an obscuration. Clearly obscures the nature of mind. And how to overcome that? Well, we're back to excitation is rooted in desire and craving. So bring in the shock, the shock troops to knock out craving and attachment. Guilt has its remedies. Shantideva in another text talks about that. Shiksha Samachaya talks about going overboard in remorse. Anxiety is rooted in attachment, so bring in the remedies. Very useful. But among the five jhana factors, this is an interesting one. Among the five jhana factors, another factor that arises in the natural course, and some of you have experienced it, you've reported, naturally arises with no external stimulation, no objective stimulation. Pritti, it's called in Sanskrit. Bliss. Bliss. Got a sharp edge to it. Bliss. Joy. Delight. It's rising right out of your mind. It's not dependent upon some stimulation, some optic, some appearance. That arises. Well, you can't feel blissful and guilty at the same time. Right? You can't feel blissful and anxious at the same time. And excitation, as it's defined in Buddhism, as a mental factor, is rooted in craving. But if you're already blissful, you don't need to crave for anything. You don't need to crave for any object, because you already got what the craving would be for. Right? And so, bliss acts as a natural remedy to dispel that obscuration. And it's a natural one. It comes from right within. So there's the third one. Then we have, Jingmu Nyi, Jingwa Da Mukpa. The old-fashioned, I think it must be a century-old translation, which I find charming but quite silly, is sloth and torpor. As soon as I think about sloth and torpor, I think about South America and sloths hanging. Hanging for... And looking at... There must be some other species. Yeah, I'm torpor. How are you, sloth? I'm hanging. Yeah. They're very charming terms, but they really don't tell you. They tell me more about South American animals than they do about qualities of mind. Their dullness, their laxity and dullness. Now, those have a sharp edge to them. Laxity, you have some idea. That's jingwa, laxity. Dullness is cruder, grosser. So sloth and torpor, I think, you can retire now. We'll go to laxity and dullness. Well, the analogy there is a pool of water that's overgrown with moss. Nice analogy. Can't see through it. Moss is covering the surface. Okay? And so this is exactly what veils the innate luminosity of your own awareness is dullness, laxity. That's it. That's how you fall asleep and go blotto when you fall asleep. Right? How the substrate consciousness slips into the substrate and then you don't know anything because you're sound asleep and you're not lucid. And so that clearly obscures. And what is to overcome laxity and dullness? Well, then once again, developmentally, splash cold water on your face, eat light food, go for vigorous exercise, visualize something very bright, direct your attention upwards, meditate in a light room, get plenty of exercise, reflect upon the qualities of your guru and the three jewels and develop bodhicitta, think of the higher realms, the pure realms, and so do anything to uplift, to illuminate, to brighten up your day and your mind. And that's good. That's good. That's developmental. And, not but, and, through the sheer practice of shamatha itself, another jhana factor, or factor of meditative stabilization, arises. It's called in Sanskrit vitarka, or topa in Tibetan. It's translated in two ways which are complementary. They're not in combat with each other. One is applied thought. Another is coarse investigation. When saying applied thought, I really don't think it's referring to something of mental chit-chat, thinking, 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 thinking. It's more an applied attentiveness. Applied attentiveness. Of really focusing in with real interest, with discernment, with intelligence. Boom. And so, but it's coarse. And that is, so I'll look over at Anizamba. And so I'm going to give her a little dose. That was it. My mind came out and met her, kind of, boom, we collided. It was applied, boom, connected, engaging, intent, interested, and then moving right on. It's cursory. It's not lingering. It's not penetrating. It's not probing, but it's not just kind of a dull gaze either. The analogy given in Buddhaghosa is that of striking a bell with a gong, and the initial strike, when it first hits the bell, that's applied thought. Right? That's coarse investigation. Like, okay, oh, it's a woman. It's a nun. She has short hair. She's putting on, he has, so, boom. Okay, got it. And I can give a whole description based upon a 2 second, 3 second, careful observation, right? Struck the bell. So, do that. Well, you remember. What do you do if you're practicing shamatha, like settling the mind in its natural state, and you start to space out? Get dull, fall into a state of unknowing, laxity. What do? Arouse your interest and focus. Arouse your attention. Focus. Concentrate. Yeah. I think we call that applied thought. Boom. And then in that moment, your laxity and dullness is gone. It may come back, of course. But in that moment, that was the antidote. And you apply that, but naturally, after a while, it just comes naturally. This is a jhana factor that's emerging out and becomes your possession. Steady state. So, something within the system that heals the problem. And then finally, the final obscuration among the five. And a number of you have expressed this also. It's debilitating uncertainty, vacillating doubt, afflictive skepticism. Where it just grinds you to a halt. You're not quite ready to leave. It's embarrassing. Everybody asks, where did she go? Where did she go? Oh, she gave up. Oh. I thought she would. I thought she would. Kind of flaky. Nobody wants that, so I'll stay. But I don't really want to stay. Oh, I'd like to stay, actually, but I'm not sure it's worthwhile. Why should I stay here and watch my... Why did I come fly 8,000 miles to watch my breath? I could have stayed in the airplane. I could have stayed at home. I could be having better food than this. I could be eating American food. And I can watch my breath. Why am I here? Why am I staying? I paid good money for this. Some guy's talking to me about watching my breath, and he's getting paid for that? Oh, but this is really cool. No, it isn't. It's stupid. It doesn't let you leave, doesn't let you stay. It wasn't Jimmy Durante, you know? It was an old Jimmy Durante movie. I won't, not movie, a song. But I won't sing it. I will relieve you of that burden. But you feel like you go, you feel like you want to stay, and he's got it nailed. That's the vacillating uncertainty. I think I get to achieve shamatha. Are you kidding me? What makes you so special? I don't know. So, you can't go forward, you can't go backward. And so the analogy is, coming back to the pool of water, turbid, muddy water. You can't drink it, and you can't farm it. You can't put it, nothing will grow in it. It's water. But you can't drink it, it's mud. So it's good for nothing. What do you do with muddy water? Exactly. Just look at it and say, it sure is muddy. You know, but it's kind of useless. And so is that type of uncertainty. It's afflictive, debilitating, vacillating, grinds you to a halt. You can't go backwards, you can't go forward. It just screws you up. And so, happily, there's one more jnana factor that comes up that is a natural remedy for that. And it's variously called sustained thought, and it's called subtle analysis. And so, since Anila and I are old friends, I'll take her as an example again. I think I got her. That was a careful inspection. You know, that was a careful inspection. It was not just a glance. It was not a little cursory gotcha. It was like really looking her over. Okay? And that could be the iPhone. It could be anything. It's where you get in there. And the analogy Buddhaghosa gives is once you've struck the bell, that ongoing reverberation continues after. That's like sustained thought. Careful analysis. Where you get in there and you not only strike, but you carry through, and with clarity, with precision, with some real focus. And that overcomes uncertainty. Uncertainty can't stand that. Uncertainty wants to wobble. It wants to go, and then you just go like, and it shatters. If you're uncertain about your own ability to achieve shamatha or anything else, as one of my foremost teachers, my Theravada teacher, Balangoda Ananda Maitreya said, just do it. Stop sitting there wondering whether you can do it, whether you'll achieve, how fast you'll progress, how many problems you'll have. Has anybody ever done this? Does my teacher know what he's talking about? Blah, 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 blah. Just shut up and do it. Unless you don't want to do it, then don't do it. One way or another. What do they say? Ship up or shape out. That's what we say in English. Ship up. Ship up?
Shape up.
Shape up. Shape up or ship out. Shape up. Either do the practice or ship out. But don't waste my time. You know? So either get to the practice and just do it. Do it. And then your doubt vanishes. There's no place for it. It has no hook. I'm sorry, I'm busy. Piss off. I'm busy. I'm really doing the practice now. Go bug somebody else. You know? And so it naturally dispels it. And so we come back, and this is where I'll finally end, to where we began, and that is this whole thing of rangdul, this natural release, this natural liberation, freedom, just by bringing this quality to bear, and then finding It's not just that you've changed topics and they go dormant for a little while, but they, because you're tapping into the kind of a healing power of your own substrate consciousness, they start to release themselves, and a real transformation takes place, which doesn't take place if you just change the topic. Like, get upset, watch a sitcom. Nothing changes, you just got your mind off of it. But it's right there waiting for you as soon as this sitcom is over. Same problem's there. Nothing was solved, nothing changed. Whereas this practice is designed to really bring about some deep transformation. So there we have that in the Mahayana, the Dzogchen, path teachings and so forth. Bring this quality awareness, there's a natural liberation. We go right back to the teachings of the Buddha in the Pali Canon. And lo and behold, just by doing the practice, as these obscurations, they're already there, but just by doing the practice, it's non-discursive, it's simple, it's straight, it's just focusing on your breath, or whatever your shamatha meditative object is, just by doing it. Then, the natural, and I love this metaphor, this terminology, the natural antibodies of the infections of the five obscurations, antibodies are right in the system itself. They come right out of the system and they antidote the problems. You don't have to go outside the system. They're in the system. The obscurations were already there. But as you develop the practice, the antibodies naturally emerge and they knock out the obscurations until they're gone. And when you achieve shamatha, those five obscurations are all dormant. They've all gone to sleep. And then you feel good. Because it's really nice to be healthy. So I think what the Buddha was getting at when he said, when you're still suffering from those five obscurations, you're enslaved and chained, sick, in bondage, wandering on a desert track. Well, it's when you have those five obscurations that you have what I've called genuine unhappiness. You can sit in a room all by yourself, perfectly comfortable, well-fed, a toilet right there if you need it. So all your needs are met, all your hedonic needs are met. And you can sit there and be totally miserable. And you did it all by yourself, with no help. And it's bound to happen. Insofar as your mind is afflicted by the five obscurations, put you in solitary confinement, and that'll be quite sufficient punishment. And what's punishing you? The afflictions of your own mind. They go about and, oh good, has no distractions. He, she can't be distracted from us. Let's just beat the crap out of him. And you're sitting, give me an anesthetic, where's the television? Anything. Dun, 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 anything! You know, to get my mind off my mind, because it's eating me alive here. Natural unhappiness. Your mind can make itself miserable all by itself, with no outside help whatsoever. And the five henchmen, the five obscurations, will do the dirty work. Free yourself of those five, and you're sitting in the same room, the same food, the same cool little toilet, and you're just resting in a field of bliss and sense of well-being, your mind clear, sharp, discerning, still, supple, and healthy. And that's genuine happiness. On a relative level, that's a genuine happiness of shamatha. So you have everything you need to make you miserable. You don't need any help at all. And you have everything you need be really wonderfully happy, all by yourself in a solitary room, and you don't need anything from outside. And it's all within your system. The problems are within your system, the antidotes are within your system, and the substrate underlies all of it. So what do you need a teacher for? I think to give that Dharma talk, and then to shut up and just practice. So let's do that. Settle your body in its natural state and your respiration in its natural rhythm. Then set your mind at ease by releasing your hopes and fears about the future and the past, and all cogitations about the present. With single-pointed awareness, release your attachment to the world of appearances, and come to stillness in the present moment. Loose, relaxed. Let your eyes be open, your senses all open to the six fields. And for just a little while, rest in this open presence, being still in the midst of the comings and goings of appearances. Now withdraw your attention deliberately away from the five physical sense fields to the domain of experience that lingers when all of those five are shut down, the domain of the mind. Focus there as single-pointedly as you can on the space of the mind and whatever mental events arise, focusing first of all on those appearances to your awareness within this domain that arise more objectively, mentally hearing the chit-chat, the conversations, discursive thoughts, mentally seeing the images that come to mind. As each one comes to mind, focus on it with this applied attention. Simply observe its nature and let it be, without seeking to alter any of the contents of the mind. Simply sustain your mindfulness without distraction, without grasping. be like the falcon kiting into the wind, facing the thoughts, the images, unmoved by them. As you observe the space of the mind, observe not only the appearances that arise more objectively, such as the discursive thoughts that you mentally hear, the appearances that you mentally see, but also take note of and observe the nature of the more subjective impulses, such as emotions, feelings, desires. Let your body be loose, your mind soft and relaxed, so that whatever subjective impulses arise, you note them, but without being caught up and carried away by them. They arise, and they pass. Observe their nature without evaluation, without reaction. Observe whatever arises in the space of the mind, be it more objective or more subjective. Monitor the flow of mindfulness with introspection and apply the remedies as needed. And let's continue practicing now in silence. So, very good. I still have Laura's question. I hope that was satisfactory. Sounded good, thank you. Takes care of that. Here's a really short one. What does it mean achieving shamatha in the water element or air element and so forth? So I'll give a very short answer. These are the water, the air element, and so forth. These are among the 10 kasinas or emblems, archetypal emblems. And so the process there is starting with a preliminary sign, acquired sign, counterpart sign. So in the case of water element, you gaze at a pool of water. Focus on it as a visual object until there's an acquired sign, which is an after image that arises purely mentally. You focus on that. That's your object of shamatha. You practice at that until your senses completely implode into the mental. And then the counterpart sign, this archetypal image of water element arises from the form realm, and you've achieved shamatha. And that goes for the other, for air, for earth, for fire as well. So that's that. Still trying to remember that bhikkhu's name. Serenity and Insight is the title. Nobody remembers it. It's a really well-known Burmese monk. I don't know why his name slips my mind right now. He's got a very good description. Just Serenity and Insight. I'm quite sure that's the title of the text. He covers all of that. The 10 kasinas. What? I think it's Serenity, but I could be wrong. I mean, those are two translations for Samadhi. It's all about Samadhi Vipassana. I'll get his name. It'll pop up in my mind. He's written a couple. He wrote the book. Yeah, he wrote the book, The Miracle of Mindfulness. Does that ring a bell? Published by Wisdom. Okay, I'm sure people on the podcast or on Iwanita, they know it, but I can't remember right now. But it's easy to find. So if you want to check it, I mean, it's a good solid piece of scholarship. And if you check out The Miracle of Mindfulness, then you'll see the author. And then there's a much more tactical book. His book, I think it's called Serenity and Insight. Same author, and that'll pop up too. Say it again. Gunaratana. Thank you. Gunaratana. That's right. Bhante Gunaratana. That's right. Burmese monk, good scholar, and his book is critical. The popular one I'm not that crazy about, because I think he went into more of the modern mindfulness is bare attention mode, that really has no basis in Theravada Buddhism. But his more scholarly text, and I believe it's called Serenity and Insight, that's very good scholarship. Hola, so we're moving right on. At the end of the Saturday morning session, you mentioned that many phenomena cannot be explained within a purely physical worldview, sure, but that they fit perfectly into the view of the nested layers of coarse, subtle, and very subtle mind. Can you elaborate on that, especially on how that, what we call the physical world, can be mapped onto this view? Well, sure. I mean, all we're talking about here are three modes of consciousness, three dimensions of consciousness, rikpa, which is utterly transcendent, substrate consciousness, you know about coarse mind. And I have dealt with this in a lot of detail in various books, Mind in the Balance, cover it in detail, cover it in a strong interface with physics in the book Hidden Dimensions, so for background, because obviously I have to give a short response right now. But there's a principle that runs through all of Vajrayana Buddhism especially, and that is as long as we're embodied, so alive, for every mental state you experience, from the coarsest, psychosis, massive neurosis, anger, joy, virtuous states of mind, substrate consciousness, and even rikpa itself, whatever you're experiencing, on all the levels, from rikpa up to the coarsest psychopathic state of consciousness, everything there. As long as we're embodied, there is always some physiological correlate taking place in the body. Now, when it gets to rikpa level, or even substrate level, substrate consciousness, it's very subtle. It's still physical. Still physical. So all this is to say is there's always a physical correlate. That's just a big principle in Vajrayana Buddhism. No matter what's happening. And now they don't locate it all in the brain. Brain obviously has a big function there, but it's distributed throughout different chakras, the nadis and so forth in the body. So it's simply to say that there are always physiological correlates to every subjective state of consciousness we experience at any time. Now that's a fundamental Vajrayana premise. It's been around for many, many hundreds of years. The exact nature of those correlations is now being happily and with great sophistication and rigor being unveiled, discovered, especially by modern cognitive neuroscience using EEG, fMRI, and so forth and so on, showing very specific parts of the brain, sometimes global activity of the brain, activation of the brain, development of new neurons, and so forth, oxygenation of the blood in different parts of the brain corresponding to different subjective mental states. And they're showing some of the very specific psychophysiological correlations that take place. And that's all very good. It's very good science. They don't know the nature of the correlation, but they know that they are correlated, right? Well, Vajrayana said, well, I'm glad you found a lot of, you've discovered a lot of the detail work that we have been assuming all along. But that doesn't mean that the mind is the brain anymore. That means the brain is mind. They are correlated. That's what we scientifically know. So everything that I hear, and I've been to a lot of meetings now with neuroscientists, and I've learned a lot, not as much as they would wish me to learn, but I've learned something. All of that fits in totally into the Vajrayana view. Very good. You're finding more and more correlations. Yeah. You're not telling us anything about the nature of the correlation, but that there are correlations that you can stimulate with a microelectrode, neuron, ganglia of neurons here, and it stimulates, it arouses some subjective experience of a particular type. Stimulate this, it arouses a very specific memory. Damage this, and now you no longer experience emotion, or you don't experience red, or what have you. It's very cool. It shows how very specific parts of the brain, systems within the brain are correlated to mental states. And you can get that by monkeying with the brain, you know, stimulating it, damaging it, and so forth. But now another whole field, which is of equal importance and studied far, far less, is this rather relatively new field of neuroplasticity. And that is by thinking certain thoughts, generating certain emotions, engaging in certain meditative practices, doing things with your mind, how that has a substantial physical impact on the brain, resulting in the growth of new neurons, systemic functional changes, structural changes. I mean, and of course the placebo effect. I always hate saying it because it's so profoundly the wrong label, because it's just exactly, of course, not an effect of the placebo. It's a mental effect, but the materialist who coined that couldn't stand to call it a mental effect. So they call it a placebo effect, because at least the placebo is physical. And a lot of them thought the only thing that has any causal efficacy is physical stuff. So they call something that's purely a mental effect something that it's not. Which is, okay, I can elaborate on that and I won't. But there it is. But it's a well-known scientific fact for now, and it's been scientifically studied for about 50 years by now. And that is just true. If you believe that some sugar tablet's gonna heal you of your migraine headache, of depression, of high blood pressure, and who knows what, warts. I mean, you know, the placebo effect works all over the place for physiological issues, psychological issues, and so forth. And of course it's not a placebo effect, it's a salt tablet, or a sugar tablet. Or it doesn't even have to be a physical substance. It can be a really, not like me, but you know, a really dignified looking doctor with a white coat and saying, listen to this syllable. Harvard. That will cure you. Right? Just listen, Harvard. Medical school. You should be feeling better already. So it doesn't have to be a physical substance. It could be a sound. It could be a gesture. It could be pretty much anything. And if you believe it, right, belief, trust, and expectation. Belief, desire, and expectation. That's the gist of the so-called placebo effect. Of course, the placebo effect is a salt tablet. But they themselves start influencing the brain, and by way of the brain, all kinds of systems within the body. So, the simple point there, all of this makes perfectly good sense in the understanding of coarse mind arising independence upon brain, and that's assumed. It's assumed in the independence of whole nervous system, the prana system, which is much more frequently referred to in the Buddhist tradition, the Hindu tradition, the Taoist tradition, the Chinese, the Ayurvedic, and so forth. They're all talking about energy systems. Oh. And that, of course, I mean, people have known ever since people have been getting head injuries that tends to influence your mind more than getting an elbow injury, a kneecap injury, a foot injury, breaking an arm. Been known for an awful long time, you know, as opposed to, you know. And so there's some strong correlation up there in the brain, for sure. And, of course, my favorite example, analogy, only as a thought experiment, do not try this at home. But you take somebody's perfectly good head, and they're smiling at you and say, "Hi, Mark." And then you just start hitting them slowly with a hammer on top of the head. Just keep on hitting them heavily. And they say, "Hi, Mark." And then, and then, and then, and then you're dead. So you're just shutting, you know, you just hit it enough times and vision goes and sound goes and thinking goes and emotion goes and then you're dead. And so, you know, just keep on damaging it enough and the whole system shuts down. But that's not news either, right? And so if all you're looking at is the physical, then you will assume, as a number of philosophers of mind say, the mind is what the brain does. If all you're looking at is the brain, if all you're looking at is the brain and behavior, what other conclusion are you possibly going to draw? You have no choice. That's it. Your conclusion is already predetermined by your methodology, which is meant it's no conclusion at all. It's completely circular. And so they're simply assuming, without a shred of evidence, just like the luminiferous ether, that the mind must be nothing more than a front. That is, all your subjective experience, emotions, images, memories, and all of that are either properties of brain, or they're either properties, qualities, or functions, or emergent properties of the brain. But that's it. But come what may, it is the brain, or it's a function of the brain, or emergent property of the brain. Because they can't think anything else. Their system does not allow them to think anything else. Therefore, if you damage the brain sufficiently, then consciousness is gone because it came from the brain in the first place. They start with no evidence, they end with no evidence. They start with a big assumption and end with the same assumption, but they call it a conclusion. And so, well, that's because they're working in the wrong place. If you want to understand consciousness, look at consciousness. So, in terms of the coarse mind, the materialistic worldview works quite well. Drug the brain, it changes the mind. You know, get the placebo effect, it changes the brain, and so forth. It all works. But it doesn't account for the substrate consciousness. And so that's why I'm saying that it works within its narrow field, like classical physics, with its assumptions of absolute space, time, mass, or energy. All works within a limited domain, but as soon as you step out of the domain, it doesn't work at all. And your fundamental assumptions were wrong entirely. And so, similarly, if you discover the substrate consciousness, then you see that none of these mental events are arising from the brain at all. They never have. They're arising from the substrate consciousness, from the substrate. And the brain conditions them. And that's true. It's always been true. And then if you studied Rigpa, if you've not studied, but if you fathom Rigpa, then you see that now things like remote viewing can be understood. Remote viewing makes no sense. If you have only a one-tiered model, it makes absolutely no sense. Because your brain is entirely inside your skull. It must be impossible for remote viewing to take place. I've studied physics enough. There is no physical explanation. Not in any physics that anybody knows about now to explain remote viewing if the mind is the brain. Because this is a pretty tightly sealed container here. Remote viewing, forget about it. Yeah? So that doesn't make any, it can't be explained. It's a hole. It's a hole. Like it's the ultraviolet catastrophe in late 19th century physics. And likewise, precognition. A lot of people have experienced it. There's no way. There's no way that's going to be true. But if you look at those two, precognition and remote viewing, which in the Buddhist tradition is just universally accepted in all traditional forms of Buddhism, and for which there is evidence, but not entirely compelling for modern science, for one thing, they're not training anybody for 5,000 hours in shamatha and so forth. They're getting people a little bit naturally gifted and then they're doing statistical analysis. Oh, never terribly compelling to the skeptic. But if your view is only a two-tiered model, that is, if you have children recalling past lives, that makes no sense within a materialistic model. There's no part of your brain that is somebody else's brain 50 years ago. Makes no sense, cannot be explained. Whereas a two-tiered model, it makes perfectly good sense. It's a subtle continuum, it carries the memories. That makes sense, it's now intelligible. But if you have a two-tiered model, coarse mind and subtle mind, and then you bump up to something like remote viewing or precognition, this makes no sense. It's not intelligible. Because my substrate consciousness right now is not anywhere else. It's not 8,000 miles away. Wherever it is, it's not there. And moreover, it's not tomorrow either. If I'm having some precognitive flash or something, my substrate consciousness is not in tomorrow. It's a ray, and it's right now, and it's got a past, but it's not tomorrow. So if that's all you've got is two-tiered, you have no explanation for remote viewing or precognition. You do have it for reincarnation, that works. But But if you bring in a three-tiered model of a dimension of consciousness, pristine awareness, that is non-local and atemporal, then it's not limited by space and not limited by time. And now that makes sense too. So that's why. Something like that. But this is all a good talk. It's all a really good talk. But be far more interesting to put it to the test of experience. Okay. Well, that's all. Got a little bit of time. Okay. Oh, when practicing love, I'm glad. Any question on loving kindness, I'm happy. When practicing loving kindness, and I wish, for example, that somebody would find his inner source of happiness, experiencing a deep sense of inner peace and envision that the person finds and experiences this, I sometimes start to feel waves of energy going through the body. This feels that I can attend much more clearly and send it through. It often happens when I feel, I think it says inspired. It often happens when I feel inspired. It often happens when I feel inspired. What do I do with this? Go with the flow, ignore them. It always gives a kind of buzz. Yeah. It's interesting. The Buddha, I think I have this in my notes on the Four Immeasurables. The Buddha lists 11 qualities of the benefits of cultivating loving kindness. And one of them is that the mind easily settles in samadhi. That's encouraging. Yeah. So, yeah, overall, I give a short answer to that one. Yeah, go with the flow. The buzz is nice. It's the energy. It's the pranas moving with the body. It's very healthy. It's good for you. Combine that with shamatha, you have a real winning combination. It's very good. Then, if one who has achieved shamatha, but didn't have time to proceed along the mundane or super mundane paths, what should this person do in order to avoid losing it in his or her future life? Oh, good question. Yeah. One thing would be to practice, do not confine your practice to shamatha alone. Since Nico? Yeah. Don't confine your practice to shamatha alone. It's too meager a diet, right? Like brown rice. It's really good food, but it's not a complete food. And so, as one is practicing, this is why, for example, this isn't just a shamatha retreat. We're doing the Four Immeasurables. And you can see a lot of other themes come in. The whole theme of genuine happiness, developing, you know, more authentic right intention, authentic intention, more meaningful motivations. Having a clearer and clearer sense of a real path of spiritual evolution, transformation, and freedom. Developing together with this, the loving kindness, the compassion, this embracing heart of all sentient beings. Leading an ethical way of life. I think there's really been quite a high standard here among our community here, the staff. I'm very content. I haven't heard anything bad. Once in a while, we're bound to screw up here or there, but overall, really, really good. And so that's very meaningful. We have a foundation in ethics. It's wonderful. Motivation, good. Practice is good. Opening of the heart is good. Having some vision of where is this all leading? What are the possibilities? That whole first phase of loving kindness that I teach, envisioning your own flourishing, envisioning what is your heart's desire. All of that is setting a course, kind of like a navigation chart. And so if one achieves shamatha that doesn't go beyond it in this lifetime, then what is all important is the context of that development and that achievement of shamatha. What were the aspirations? What was the motivation? What is your larger vision? What was the ethical context for it, the ethical basis for it? If we practice fully, we start with motivation, end in very traditional Mahayana fashion, by dedicating merit, by the power of this practice, may this go to the realization of, and then very meaningful aspirations. All of that, even if you are just practicing shamatha and you don't achieve it, or if you do achieve it, all of that will take that energy and just propel it in a really good direction. So, and then there is another very practical issue. Maybe I'll end on this one. It's really hard to practice and to achieve shamatha all on your own without any instruction from anybody, whatever. Let alone if you don't even have a good book. You know, just think, I think I'll practice shamatha. I have no idea what it means, but I'm going to start right now. I wonder how I do it. Maybe it's on the internet. You know, so having a teacher, having a community, having good sources, you know, good books, authoritative sources, authentic sources, As His Holiness said, I probably quoted it even in this retreat, but he was asked on one occasion, I was with him, he was asked, is it necessary, you remember? Is it necessary to have a guru to achieve enlightenment? You remember his answer? No. But it can save you a lot of time. And so there's a connection. This means an enormous amount to me, because I know where, what little understanding I have, I know where it comes from. It's no big mystery. There's no mystery at all. I just go right back to my teachers, and I learned this from him, and this from him, and this from her, and this from her, and this from him, and him, and him, and him. You know? And then augmenting it, I'm also very deeply grateful for the teachers, the professors I've had in Western academia. That's also enriched my understanding, made it richer. And so, but in terms of future life, I, as much as I appreciate my Western professors, I don't actually pray to encounter them in future lives. If I do, that might be fine, but I'm not sure whether future lives are going to take them. I'm being the same litter of puppies. I'm not quite sure. But when I think of my teachers, you know, my lamas and so forth, my Theravada teachers, then here's something else pretty core. If you find a teacher in whom you really have very deep trust, and it doesn't have to be one that you know very closely, it could be someone you see only from afar, like the Dalai Lama or someone like that. But if you see such an individual and you say, this one's authentic, I'd really like to be in touch with this one over the long term, then that can be a very meaningful way to dedicate the merit of one's practice. And I've asked more than one of my teachers, including His Holiness, please, in future lives, always hook me with the hook of your compassion so that I connect with you again. His Holiness is, yeah, yeah. Roya. So that can be very meaningful. If I want to think about hell, all I need to think about is life with no Dharma and no teacher. That pretty much does it for me. Barren wasteland. So having good spiritual friends, really important. Okay? Onaso. Enjoy your day, and it's time for me to say my motto. See you around.